From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, an update of news and events from the Latin America and Caribbean region with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo, reporting from Managua, Nicaragua. Welcome back. I'm glad to have you here with us and looking forward to this update of things in the neighborhood down there.
Well, yeah, and there's quite, as usual, there's plenty to talk about, more than enough to talk about.
Indeed.
There are so many developments, and each one is a talking point that you could spend a long time discussing. And for example, there's this latest move by the United States authorities to break with something like 50 years of precedent and insist that a U.S. nominee be voted president of the Inter-American Development Bank, and they managed to ram that through. Right. And that's just one example, as we were talking about before we started recording, that the United States, in its efforts to make sure that it can recolonize Latin America and the Caribbean successfully, is paying attention to every little detail to make sure that it has complete control,
right,
or as complete control as possible,
right,
over possible eventualities that may affect the success or otherwise of its continental strategy in South Latin America and the Caribbean.
Right.
So, and if you look at the Inter-American Development Bank, and for example, in the case of Nicaragua, the Inter-American Development Bank hasn't done anything with Venezuela for a long, long time,
right,
and obviously it hasn't with Cuba either. But it was a bank that made several very important loans over the last 10, 12, 13 years to Nicaragua, which Nicaragua has used to build hospitals and build its highway infrastructure, which is now something like the third best in the whole of Latin America, according to independent bodies that look at that kind of stuff.
Right.
And so then if you look at the Inter-American Development Bank, and it's interesting how its voting structure works, because just the U.S. and Canada between them have 34% of voting rights. So, and if they only need another 16-17% of votes from the other members, the borrowing members and the non-borrowing members of the Inter-American Development Bank,
right,
to be able to block a loan to a country that they deem unfit, like Nicaragua. And so over the last couple of years, I think it's almost 2 years now, ever since 2018, Nicaragua has been unable to get any loans from the Inter-American Development Bank. And that's because the US and Canada have that 34% of voting rights, and then Brazil has 11%, and other right-wing governments in the region have 3-1, and when you tot it all up, they have plenty with which to block any loans to Nicaragua, and that's what the United States has managed to achieve. And so Nicaragua now depends on loans that were either approved before the IADB, the Inter-American Development Bank, froze loans to Nicaragua, or it depends on organizations that are not subject to a U.S. veto, like, for example, the Central American Bank for Economic Integration, from which they recently got, and I think they got a total of getting on for $300 million worth of loans from that bank. And so it's not that Nicaragua doesn't have access to international finance to finance its development, and it's the country in the region that's regarded, even by the Inter-American Development Bank functionaries themselves, as one of the best, if not the best, countries in terms of efficient use of the loans that they receive. And that's true of the World Bank as well, and it's certainly true of the Central American Bank for Economic Integration. So, but that's just an example of the way the United States, in the most vindictive and unfair way, And talking about fairness in the context of the United States is ridiculous, isn't it? But anyway, and that's one of the ways in which they impose their will on countries, because countries don't want to fall foul of the United States and thus not be eligible for loans from the World Bank or the Inter-American Development Bank. And that's just another aspect, isn't it, Don?
Here's one too. There's some cute things. In March of 2015, for example, they updated, quote-unquote, their institutional strategy for the decade 2010 to 2020. This has to be considered really an Obama administration initiative, because the United States not only holds 30% of the shares itself, but Europe, the non-borrowers, in other words, the U.S., the U.K., Germany, France, Spain, Portugal, all the colonial powers. You could almost invite the Pope from the 16th century into the room to help divvy everything up. They control 49.98%. So if you get Belize or Paraguay or whatever to vote with the with the colonials, then they control it, and that's what happens all the time. But in March of 2015. They changed the institutional strategy for the decade that we're still in, where before it said social exclusion and inequality were one of the three major problems that they had. That is now looked at, that public policy needs to address gender equality and diversity, climate change, and environmental sustainability, and institutions and rule of law. So in other words, economic inequality is a problem, so we're going to solve it by solving gender equality and climate change. In other words, we're not going to solve it. We're going to, quibble over this other stuff. And that was the recent change that's governed the operation of the bank up until this year. And now we're seeing that they're just taking the reins directly in their hands, of course. And we're going to run it ourselves, is, I guess, what they've decided to do.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And so, but whereas beforehand there was countries like Nicaragua that were not entirely looked upon kindly by the United States, had a chance of getting funding. For example, in Corn Island off Nicaragua's Caribbean coast, they installed a solar power system to power the island's electricity generation. Mm. And I think that was an IADB loan. And now, of course, they can't. So, it's just another example of what we're talking about. And another, let's just shift the scene from finance to human rights validation, if you like. And one of the things that's happened over the last few days is that Michelle Bachelet's been up to her old tricks, condemning Venezuela, Cuba, and Nicaragua in the Human Rights Council in Geneva. And of course, all three countries have rejected that. Now, I don't know if this is okay with you, Don, but what I'd like to do is talk about something I did, a study that I did at the end of August, which throws a lot of light on the way essentially international human rights institutions and organizations are really accomplices to organized crime.
Oh yeah, please bring it.
But in a very specific sense. I mean, we all know. Anybody with half a brain and any awareness of what goes on in the world will know that the biggest international crime organization is the United States government, and they, for example, they control the drugs trade internationally. Just have to look at the way heroin production and distribution rocketed in Afghanistan once the United States overthrew the Taliban government there back in whenever it was 2001. Yeah, and the same way they sent all their resources of the Southern Command to the Caribbean to harass Venezuela on the pretext that Venezuela is a drugs producing and trading country, and of course 85% something like that of cocaine production from South America travels from Colombia up the Pacific.
Of course. Well, and you know, not for nothing. The drug users must be, and the drug manufacturers must be in Venezuela. It's not in the places where they imagine that Juan Guaido is president. They couldn't be hallucinating on drugs, those people. It must be the Venezuelans who think it's Maduro that's president.
They must be
on drugs.
Right, they must be on drugs, yeah. So, but I'm looking at something much more specific than that. We know that. Anybody who's aware of how the United States operates in the world and has operated from way back, from the days of Lucky Luciano in Italy and the mafia there at the end of the Second World War, and how they used Lucky Luciano all the way through their Asian wars, in particular Vietnam, and how the CIA was the major organizer of the drugs industry and its distribution networks there, and so on and so on and so on. We know all that. But I'm talking about something much more specific and here in Latin America. And that is that, oh, and also, of course, in Syria and Libya, where, as President Assad and his government pointed out over the last few days, the U.S. government has used organized crime in Syria to advance its attack on the Syrian government there. And of course, Turkey is up to its eyes in organized crime.
Right.
But anyway, or the Turkish authorities. But anyway, in the case of Nicaragua, what I did about 3 weeks ago was I took 3 days off and I went to talk to victims of the 2018 failed coup attempt here. And I spoke to about 22. No, actually, it was I did 22 interviews, but the interviews were with a total of 29 people over 3 days. And what I was looking at was, I asked them, what was your experience of the events of 2018, in particular in relationship to the so-called anti-canal movement and the Movimiento in Nicaragua from about 2013, 2014 onwards? There sprang up what was called the anti-canal movement, and that subsequently morphed and changed into something that called itself the Movimiento Campesino.
Right.
And that was a totally U.S.-funded phenomenon involving a very small number of campesinos in national terms. You're probably talking about a group of maybe 2,000, 3,000 people. But they were very well organized, and they were led by a woman called Francisca Ramirez, and later on Francisca Ramirez was joined by a guy called Medardo Mairena. Now, if you read the international coverage of Nicaragua, Medardo Mairena and Francisca Ramirez are always projected as humble campesino or peasant leaders who have been systematically victimized by the repressive Ortega dictatorship.
Of course.
Okay. So I went down there and I interviewed all these people, and it's absolutely clear that what Ramirez and Medardo have operated over the last 4, 5, 6 years in that region, in the Central Highlands region, the Chontales and Nueva Guinea region of Nicaragua, is very much an organized crime operation.
Right.
And what they do is, they intimidate people, and if you collaborate with them, well, they'll solve your trivial problems from their point of view. And problems, for example, of a campesino family that needs to buy some medicine for one of their family members, or they have a property dispute and they want that sorted out, and it's a classic mafia style social work.
Right.
We'll take care of you if you do what we say. And if you don't do what we say, well, we'll kill you. Or we'll burn your trucks.
Godfather, I have a stone in my shoe.
Yeah. And I talked to business people there who, it wouldn't be true to say that they were afraid, in the sense of that Francisco Ramirez and Mairena would send somebody around to shoot them. But they were very wary of getting on the wrong side of them because it could cause them problems for their business.
Right.
And now what is that? That is organized crime.
Yep.
Just in that sense. But in 2018, that actually came to a head when Ramirez and Medardo Mairena set up these roadblocks at key points along in Nicaragua's highway system in that area. And anybody passing through that those roadblocks had to pay a toll. But Francisco Ramirez and Mairena, their trucks carrying cattle and milk, dairy products, cheese to Managua, they had no problem going through
right.
because Ramirez and Mairena controlled the roadblocks. And so what would happen would be, say that you're a cattle owner and you are taking your cattle to a slaughterhouse not far from Managua.
Right.
And you were trying to pass through half a dozen roadblocks. So every roadblock, you'd have to pay money. And if you didn't have money, they'd take one of your beasts.
Right. This is basically you're paying your competition to be able to come to market
right.
because they have control.
Right. So what did that do? What that did was it intimidated the population. It created income for the criminals who were organizing the coup against Nicaragua's democratically elected government. And it personally enriched people like Francisco Ramirez and Medardo Mairena.
Right.
So that's benign, okay? Anybody that was a Sandinista stood a good chance of getting at least beaten up and further along the range of human rights abuses, they could be tortured and eventually they could be murdered. And that did happen.
Mm.
And So you have there the whole gamut of offences that form the kind of structural operational activity of organised crime, and in addition to that, what happened was in people in the United States may not realise this, but one of the things that happened was that the Episcopal Conference, the Catholic bishops here in Nicaragua, very early on in May, called on the president to withdraw the police from the streets because they said the police made it impossible for peaceful demonstrations and peaceful protests to take place.
I remember
this. That was their argument. So the police were withdrawn from the streets in order to see what was to give them, the opposition, a chance to sit down and negotiate. And at that time, that was one of the conditions that the bishops put to enter into dialogue with the government and the opposition. And so what happened then? What happened then was that the people like Francisco Ramirez and Medardo Mairena were free to do what they liked. And so they intensified their control of the roadblocks, and they intensified the criminal activities that they engaged in at their roadblocks.
Right.
And as the negotiations progressed, whenever the opposition felt that they needed to put more pressure on the government, there'd be some atrocity. For example, in Managua, early in July, a family was burned to death in a house in a barrio, the Carlos Marx barrio there in Managua, and that was blamed on the government. And of course, it wasn't a government crime at all. It was a crime carried out by the opposition. And other incidents would happen. So, for example, I think it was early in July, I think it was July 12th, the opposition sent 200 of their gunmen to attack a police station that had about 11 police officers in it. I think it was nine, no, it was 13. It was 13 police officers. And they arrived in, it was at a place called El Morito. They arrived there. They opened fire on the police. They had very heavy grade military weapons, and they killed four police officers, kidnapped nine, and took those nine police officers to one of their roadblocks operated by Francisco Ramirez and Medardo Mairena. And I interviewed the survivors of that attack, the police officers who survived that attack, and just horrific treatment. I mean, it's lucky that they were able to survive. And they were at serious risk of being killed, but Medardo Mairena and his team, he was present while the police officers were being ill-treated. He said to them, well, we're not going to kill you because we're going to interchange you for some of our people that are held by the police. And so after interviewing all these people, I mean, these 29 people that suffered as a result of Ramirez's and Mairena's activities, it only dawned on me as a result of those interviews that what the international human rights organizations are doing is they're serving as direct accomplices to these criminal activities. They whitewash them. They present Mairena and Ramirez as victims, when in fact Ramirez and Mairena are the people that perpetrated the very worst human rights abuses that took place during that failed coup attempt. So there's a group of us working on that now, and so we're going to produce all the relevant documentation about it. But I just thought that it's interesting for you and our listeners to realize the extent to which for example, the Inter-American Human Rights Commission or Michelle Bachelet's Office of the High Commission, the UN High Commission for Human Rights, or Human Rights Watch, or Amnesty International, or any of these groups. There's a group. The reason I'm particularly interested in Ramirez and Mairena is because there's a human rights group called Frontline Defenders in Ireland that have been funding Ramirez and Mairena for years now, not insubstantial sums of money. And the interesting thing about them is that Dennis O'Brien, the Irish businessman who founded Frontline Defenders, is a very close crony of Bill and Hillary Clinton. And so you can see the way that the international corporate-funded human rights industry ties into the human rights institutions, including the UN, which nobody should be surprised about.
Right.
And they operate essentially as an extramural arm of the United States State Department foreign policy.
Right. I mean, you've had reports, for example, you know, Saudi Arabia is probably the worst violator of human rights on the planet. The way they treat people, the SPCA would have you arrested for doing that to an animal in the United States. They contributed money to HRW, for example, Human Rights Watch. You've got, you know, the Saudis were chairing one of the UN human rights committees. I don't know if they still are, if it was that enough of an embarrassment to remove them. But there's the most ridiculous relationships that are visible and discoverable. What you have to call the human rights industry, because it has nothing to do with human rights. It has to do with whitewashing, human rights violators.
Oh yeah, and when the representatives of Venezuela, Cuba, and Nicaragua condemn Michelet's politicization of human rights, and they're talking about something that's very, very real. And you talk about Saudi Arabia, and Saudi Arabia has been responsible for a massive genocide in Yemen.
Right, today's news or yesterday's news. You had a press conference yesterday. We're talking Tuesday, the 15th. Press conference at the White House with Netanyahu and the foreign ministers of the United Arab Emirates and Bahrain. Okay, both of these, for example, this is supposed to be a big peace agreement with Israel. It's, you know, monumental. It's huge, in Trump's words or whatever. Of course, the relationship between these three countries has been ongoing for many, many years. It's the only people that it's been a secret from are the American people, the Bahraini people, and the people in the UAE, because they would rise up if they knew about it. And the only thing that's changed is that now they're going to know. But Bahrain is itself occupied by Saudi Arabia. There was an uprising in 2014 by the people there, a peaceful one, peaceful like Martin Luther King peaceful. The people stood up, despite the fact that more than half of their real estate is occupied by the U.S. Navy, The biggest Navy base in the Middle East is Bahrain, basically. And they stood up anyway, deposed the king there, and demanded democracy. And Saudi Arabia came in and reinstalled the king and suppressed this, bloodily suppressed the peaceful uprising there, with the help, of course, of the acquiescence of the United States, who could have sent a shore patrol outside of the borders of the base there and kicked the Saudis back to where they belong. So, you know, there's a whole operating infrastructure, I guess that's my point, between the U.S. military, the Saudis, who were the biggest, you know, oppressors of and violators of human rights in human history, maybe, looking at the scope of it in Yemen, and organizations like Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International, which take money from these people to take money from Americans who think they're actually defending human rights by giving money to these organizations.
Yeah, and an example closer to home here in Latin America is Colombia. In Colombia, there have been 57 massacres so far this year. And just yesterday, another ex-fighter of the FARC who'd signed up for the peace agreement was also murdered, bringing the total, getting up close to 200 now.
Which is what you predicted was going to happen. When they reached the peace agreement, you looked back at the peace agreement from, you know, the previous one 20 years ago or whatever, said when the FARC surrenders its weapons, they're going to come in and massacre them, and that's going to happen again sooner or later. And essentially that's what's been happening, right?
Oh, yeah. And perhaps not on the same scale as happened in the days of the left-wing movement. I've forgotten what it's called now, Unidad Popular or something like that.
Right, it wasn't FARC, it was the analog, right.
But yeah, and it was a political movement that was sympathetic to the FARC. Essentially, it was, some people might view it as the political wing of the FARC, and they suffered, and I've forgotten what the figure is, and some people put it as high as 3,000 deaths between the late 80s and the early 90s. Right. Unidad Patriotica, they were called. Unión Patriotica. But that figure of 57 massacres is of people that don't have anything, that didn't have anything to do with the FARC guerrillas. Those massacres were of indigenous people, of community leaders, of people claiming involved in land claims and so on, people protesting government measures and local government measures, and what's the object of those massacres? I mean, the object of those massacres is to terrorize people so they don't protest when the government and the corporations that it's friendly with try and impose their will in a given area. And so, and in Colombia, imagine if there'd been 57 massacres in Venezuela so far this year.
Oh my goodness.
You wouldn't hear yourself for the outcry.
Southcom would establish its headquarters in Caracas by now.
Right.
You know.
So there you have a very clear example of the way, in effect, in Colombia, although Alvaro, this is something that we haven't been able to talk about because we haven't been in touch for so long. But one of the things that's happened in Colombia over the last 3-4 weeks is that the Colombian authorities detained former President Alvaro Uribe for his involvement in paramilitary crimes and bribery of relating to electoral offenses.
That's going to be interesting. We're going to have to talk about that next week because we're out of time. Thank you so much for your time this week. Yeah, well, we'll definitely look at what's happened with Uribe. Ever since that last election, things have been sort of interesting, and we'll follow that up. So thanks again, and we'll speak with you next week.
Okay, thanks, Don. I look forward to it. Take care now.
You too.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.